Hi, my name is Brian, and I'm Holy City's Pastor of Vision. I'm glad you found our online sermon resources, and I pray that the Lord would use them to strengthen your faith. I would exhort you not to use our online sermons as a substitute for regular involvement in your own local church. That being said, I pray that our teaching resources would be helpful to you and conform you even more to the image of Christ.
Beloved, beauty is a powerful thing. Glory is a powerful and compelling thing, is it not? Think with me about this. Think about the mother who's straining through the pains of childbirth does so for the glory of beholding that little one that she has been nurturing for 9 long months. Think of the soldier far away from home. What is it that compels him to carry on, but not the beauty of his wife in his mind's eye and the hope to return to her? Think of maybe a time, like I've had before, when you've been on a long hike and you're weary with the length and weary with the heat and don't think you can take another step. And then you suddenly turn, and opening before you is this vast and beautiful landscape, this valley just laid out before you. Is not strength revived, and you're able to press on? Or think about the experience of one brother I talked to who walking into a job that he does not care much for, pauses, lifts his eyes to behold the sunrise over the water, and is given a little bit of joy to lift his head and to walk into work that day. We are hardwired to love beauty and glory. And to behold it often grips our hearts in such a way that it compels us. It gives us strength. It gives us hope to keep going in the task that we're called to. It gives us the ability to face difficulty, to step into difficulty. And in our text this morning, in Mark's gospel, the disciples find themselves in a place of great difficulty. Jesus has announced, we read last week, that he is going to die. He has told them that they too are going to suffer. But how are these men, like us, mere humans, how are they going to keep going to this difficult call that they've been given? And I think it's in light of that we see in our text this morning, Jesus taking his inner circle of disciples, the three, Peter, James, and John, and drawing them away and giving them a little glimpse of what's to come. And my contention, my point this morning is that, brothers and sisters, we too, like the disciples, we need to behold the glory of Jesus so that we will not lose heart, so that we can take up our cross and follow Christ. As I think through the church, I think about so many difficulties weighing on us, weighing on you, that could cause you to lose heart this morning. I think about financial pressure. I think about failing health. I think about family difficulty in extended families or maybe in marriage relationships. I think about friends moving away. I think about failed dreams and expectations, and struggles with the same sin over and over again. I think about the lack of conversions we've seen so far. I think about burdens from our past that we still carry, or mistreatment by the world that we receive, or the death of loved ones, or the drudge of the daily grind at work, or a culture that whenever we flip on the TV, they are openly opposing the things we hold dear, or the weariness that comes to you who are raising multiple young children, or you who've lost jobs or battle with depression and mind-maddening anxiety, and really I could go on, and we're just a small body, right? These things are tempting us to lose heart. And so my aim this morning is that together as a church, we would behold the glory of Christ this morning. And in doing so, we would be compelled to keep following Him and to follow Him with hope. So that's really kind of my outline I want to follow is first I want to call you to behold Him. And then I want to call you to follow Him. My first point is to behold just a glimpse. Just get a glimpse this morning of the glory of Christ. And then I want to call you to follow Him with hope. So let's look back down at our text. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, here's the context, here's the stage, right? Is that the disciples find themselves in a very difficult position. In chapter 8, Peter rightly confessed that Jesus is not John the Baptist, He's not Elijah, He's the Christ, He's the King. And Jesus, we read last week, for the first time in the gospel flow, has told His disciples that He is going to suffer and die. Peter, so astonished and confused by this, right, is so bold as to rebuke Jesus. Drew taught us about that last week. But then, as the text went on last week, Jesus drops another bomb on the disciples, right? Not only is He going to suffer and die, but you're going to suffer too. You've got to take up your cross and follow Me. So this is a crisis point in the lives of the disciples. And let me explain what I mean. Not only is their leader going to be killed and rise again, they're still unsure about what that's going to look like, but they too are called to take up the worst possible instrument for death, the cross. And so I think in their minds, they were hearing like literal cross, literal death. And as we know, for many of them, that's what they faced. So they're at a crossroads. They're at a crisis. Okay, this is not what we thought was going to happen. This is not what we thought the Messiah was going to do. This is not the triumphal overtaking of all of our enemies. No, this is a hard truth. This is a path of suffering. And they need something. They need something injected into them, some encouragement, some affirmation that this is all part of the plan, some miracle to give them hope so that they won't lose heart and fall away. And our story of the Transfiguration this morning is exactly that. Is exactly that. We see in verse 2 that it says, after 6 days, Jesus took up with Him Peter, James, and John. This is the only time, really, in Mark's gospel that he gives an intentional time period marker of 6 days or something like that. And I think that's to show that this is related to what just happened. He intentionally picks his inner three and he draws them away and he draws them up and he gives them a glimpse of His glory. We're going to walk through that in a minute. I think a comment that I heard this week is helpful. One preacher said, Peter had confessed that Jesus is the Messiah, and now they're going to get a sense of it. Now they're going to get a real sense, an experience of who Jesus truly is. So I want to walk through verses 2 to 8 with you at first, and just notice four little glimpses of Jesus' glory that the disciples receive. First, there is a visual glimpse. He leads them, verse 2 says, high up on a mountain by themselves. And look at this intentionality. He's transfigured before them. And His clothes become radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. Jesus is radiant. He's intensely and exceedingly white. His clothes are so white that it's clearly supernatural. I think that's what Mark's getting at where he says, no one, no launderer on earth could pull this off. No amount of bleach could get things this white. In Matthew's account of this situation, he says that Jesus' face shone like the sun before them. And of course, these are all pictures and images from the Old Testament of divinity, where light and whiteness and brightness is something that happens when you see God and when God reveals himself. So this is not natural. This is clearly supernatural. And it's a glimpse into Jesus' glory that he has inherent in his person. I listened to a brother named Kevin DeYoung preach through this passage this week, and he said this, it was really helpful. He said, it's not like Jesus was putting on a mask, but it was more like he was taking away a veil, right? Those are two different things. It wasn't that he added glory onto his person, but he kind of just showed them a little bit of who he has been the whole time. Jesus gives his disciples a visual glimpse into who he truly is. And he radiates before them. But that's not it. There's also this, what I'm calling a prophetic glimpse. Look at this, verse 4. Mark tells us, and there appeared to them Elijah and Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. So not only is Jesus standing there shining like the sun, he's now having a conversation before the three disciples, with two of the greatest men in Israel's history. Of course, for Moses and Elijah, if we know our Bibles well, right, this is not the first time that they've been on a mountain and had an experience with God. Right? Moses, of course, met with God and received the law on Mount Sinai. And Elijah also met with the Lord during a low point in his ministry on Mount Horeb, which is really another name for Mount Sinai. So same mountain. Interesting. And this is not the first time that Moses and Elijah are mentioned together in the story of the Bible. I want us to flip back to the last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. So if you can flip back to chapter 4, and I want to read with you just a few verses. Malachi is the end of the Old Testament, and Malachi 4, of course, is the last chapter of the Old Testament. And there among the last verses of the Old Testament, we see Moses and Elijah put together. The Lord is foretelling through Malachi about the great day of the Lord. And he says this, I'll just read the whole chapter, it's short, from verses 1 to 6. He says, for behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, when the arrogant and all evildoers will be stubble. The day that is coming shall set them ablaze, says the Lord of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. You shall go out leaping like calves from the stall, and you shall tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day when I act, says the Lord of hosts. And then here it is, verse 4. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and rules that I commanded him at Horeb, or Sinai, for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the great and awesome day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. So the presence on the mountain with Jesus would have recalled this prophecy that ended the Old Testament, that spoke of both Moses and Elijah pointing forward to the great day of judgment and to the day of the Messiah. We also know, as Drew read in the call to worship this morning, early in the Bible, early in the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy 18, Moses spoke of a time when the Lord would raise up a prophet like me from among you, from among your brothers. So this is pointing to Jesus. And then Elijah here is understood as the one who would come before the great day of the Lord, and kind of a teaching that had developed through the scribes of that day is that he would also be a forerunner of the Messiah. So no accident that they are here with Jesus on the mountain in front of the disciples, giving a sort of a stamp of approval to Jesus' ministry, to him as the climax of God's revelation, that this is the great prophet. He's the one who's going to bring in the messianic age. And really, it's a small glimpse of all the prophecies that would be fulfilled. So think about what it must have been to be the three standing there with these men before Jesus. It was both probably thrilling because they understood what was happening, and dreadful. And in fact, that's what Mark says, that Peter speaks and he doesn't know what to say because he's so terrified. He just blurts out something. We're going to come back to what he says in a few minutes. So it's been visual. It's been prophetic glimpse. I want to show you a couple more. There's a tactile sort of glimpse of glory here. Look at verse 7. A cloud overshadowed them. A cloud comes down on the mountain. Maybe you've had this experience. You're driving through the mountains, and suddenly you hit a dense cloud, and you've got to do what? You got to turn on your windshield wipers, right? Because this is dense, this is heavy. Or maybe those of us who like to camp have been in a higher altitude, and the campsite's dry the night before, but you wake up and a cloud has sort of settled down, and suddenly everything's damp. Came and started a fire that morning. So a cloud has come down, and there's a bit of a, this is a tangible experience for the disciples. And yet, this is not an ordinary cloud. This is not an ordinary cloud. Scholars have pointed out that this word for overshadowed is used throughout the Old Testament to describe the Shekinah glory of God when it comes down. When God's presence fills the tabernacle, that's the word that's used. When the glory of God fills Solomon's temple, that's the word that's used. And so this overshadowing of the disciples is the very presence of God himself. He's come down on the mountain. So put yourself in the place of the disciples. They're there. Jesus is shining like the sun in utter whiteness. He's talking to these great prophets, one that's been dead for over 1,000 years. The other one we know didn't die. He left the earth in a whirlwind. And then now this great cloud comes down. But there's more. Out of the cloud, Mark tells us, verse 7, there's an audible glimpse of glory with a voice. With a voice. This is the climax of the event. The very voice of God speaking to the disciples. This is the same voice, let's not forget, who in the beginning said, "Let there be light," and there was light. This is the voice of God speaking. It's a similar situation to what we saw earlier in Mark at Jesus' baptism, right? Where the Lord speaks and says, "You are my beloved Son with whom I'm well pleased." But here's the difference here, is that God is not addressing Jesus in this passage. He's addressing the disciples, right? He doesn't say "you." He says "this." "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." So the Father coming down on the mountain is making crystal clear to the disciples who Jesus is, who his true identity is. He's not going to leave that to the disciples to figure out, right? He's going to reveal it in a very crystal clear way, an audible way. "This is my Son. Listen to him." This is the climax of this whole scene. It reminds me, I'll get nerdy on you here in a minute. It reminds me of this song called "The Transfiguration" by a guy named Sufjan Stevens. Probably very few of you have heard of Sufjan Stevens. Maybe John Kesselring. And it is his 2004 album, Seven Swans. It's the last song on the album. And it's a beautiful song that goes through the Transfiguration account. And it builds musically until it gets to the voice. And that's clear. All the instruments are going, and he recounts what the voice says. And it's a beautiful capture of the voice of God speaking as the pinnacle of what is going on here. So let me just recap, and then we're gonna think about this for us. God Himself is giving the disciples a glimpse. It's a small glimpse, but it's powerful, of Jesus' true identity. It's visually overwhelming. It's stirring their hearts because prophecy is being fulfilled. It's tangible. It's heavy as God's presence comes down. And the very voice that hung the stars is now speaking a word of encouragement to these three men at just the moment when they need it. How kind of the Lord. So let me think about with you how then this can help us, what we need to do in light of these verses. First thing I want to say is that we too must listen to Jesus, right? That was, of all the things that the Father could have said, He affirms, "This is my Son, I love Him, listen to Him." Listen to Him. Give constant heed to this man. And the context is really important, because I think the specific thing He wants the disciples to listen to is the thing they're having a hard time swallowing. This message that Jesus has to die, and that they must take up their cross and follow Him. The command of the voice is pointing back to what Jesus had just told them in the text that we read last week, and that they're struggling to accept that the Son has to suffer, and they too, as they follow the Son, will suffer. Listen to Him about this, God is saying. And it's interesting that right after He speaks that, right, suddenly, verse 8 says, looking around, Moses and Elijah are gone, and who remains? Jesus. Jesus. The Father's drawing attention. This is my Son. I love Him. Listen to Him. He's greater than Moses. He's superior to Elijah and other prophets. Give heed to His words, and especially His words about His death and our need to follow Him. So for some of us this morning, that's the word we need to hear. We need to hear, I need to give heed to this message of the Christ crucified for sinners. I am struggling under God's law. I can't keep it. I'm failing. I'm condemned. I'm trying to work my way to heaven, and I just can't do it. I need to give heed that Jesus came to die for sinners. And I need to take up my cross and follow Him. Second thing I want to draw your attention to is that, brothers and sisters, we need to behold the glory of Christ this morning. And as we do, we will be changed. We will be changed. That word in verse 2 for transfigured is a rare word in the New Testament. It's only used 4 times, and every time it speaks of a radical transformation. 2 times it's used to describe this event. A third time is Romans 12:2, that we're to be, our mind is to be renewed or changed in light of the gospel. And the fourth time is 2 Corinthians 3:18. I want to highlight something there with 2 Corinthians 3:18. Paul uses the same word to describe the change that happens to believers. He's been describing how the new covenant that Jesus has brought is far superior than the old, and that because of Jesus' death, this veil that used to keep unbelieving Jews from seeing God's glory has been lifted. And now he says in verse 18, we all with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed, same word, into the same image from one degree of glory to another. So beholding, merely gazing at the glory of Jesus, changes us, transforms us. This is the intended, one of the intended effects that the Lord wants to have on us this morning as we think about His glory. Paul would go on in 2 Corinthians to talk about the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. There is a great book I would recommend to you by Milton Vincent called A Gospel Primer for Christians, Learning to See the Glories of God's Love. If you find yourself struggling to know that the Lord loves you, struggling with condemnation and guilt, this would be a great book to pick up. Reflecting on 2 Corinthians 3:18, he says this, "I can know that actual deposits of God's very glory are attaching themselves to my person and transforming me from one level of glory to another as I behold His glory in the gospel." This is the way God intends to change us, is that we grow by gazing. We're transformed when we behold the one who was transfigured and the one who transferred His righteousness onto us. So I want to exhort you this morning, grow, brothers and sisters. Look to Jesus, and you will be changed from one degree of glory to the other. Okay, so I said earlier, my point is to help us behold the glory of Christ so that we would follow Him. Let's look at this. Let's think about what God is doing in placing this passage, this event, in this flow of Mark's gospel. Why now does He reveal this glory to the disciples? It is for this point, my second point this morning, second sermon point. Follow Him with hope. That's what the Lord wants to do in the lives of the disciples, and that's what He wants to do in your life this morning. He wants you to follow Him with hope. Let's see that second section, verses 9 to 13, and see what's going on here. Okay. Verse 9, it says, "And as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead." So here again is another one of Jesus' charges to silence for His disciples. This is not the first time we've seen this, if you've been here tracking through us with Mark. But this will be the last time. This will be the last time that Jesus calls His disciples to silence about what they've seen. And one other unique thing here is that this is the only charge to silence that He puts a sort of a time limit, a gap on it. Don't say anything until something happens. And it's until the Son of Man rises from the dead. So the disciples are told, don't relay this experience of what you've seen. Don't go tell others until the Son of Man rises from the dead. So this is unique, and we have to ask why. What's going on? So I think, like we've seen the other calls to silence, is that Jesus is trying to prevent any misunderstanding of His kingdom, misunderstanding of a messianic triumphalism, that we're just going to come in and just rule over enemies, and this is going to be easy peasy. No. He is teaching that glory, that triumph is coming, but something's got to precede it. Something's got to precede it. Suffering, death, and a resurrection have to precede this. Only when I have risen from the dead, Jesus is saying, will you be able to understand what you just saw? Will you be able to make sense of the transfiguration rightly? Because I think what he's getting at, what I'm going to try to explain, is that the transfiguration is a glimpse, it's a foretaste of what's going to happen when Jesus gets up out of that tomb and rises. And it's a foretaste, a little picture of what's going to happen when He comes back a second time. So again, the disciples, look how they respond, right? They continue to be bewildered. We're not surprised by this. Verse 10 says, "So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked Jesus, 'Why did the scribes say first that Elijah must come?'" So they're confused. They're confused, right? Didn't we just see Elijah? And isn't it that when we see him, then the end is going to come and judgment's going to come and everything's going to Everything's going to be rolled out in judgment on our enemies. Isn't that what Malachi foretells us? Why do you have to die before that would happen? What do you mean, raised from the dead? I thought that what we just saw was a sign of the coming judgment. The end is here. What is with the scribes going on and teaching that Elijah has to come first? So they're confused about what they just saw and how this relates into, why are we walking back down the mountain, right? I thought Elijah came and things are over. Jesus responds in verse 12, and he said to them, he agrees, Elijah does come first to restore all things. Right? He affirms Malachi 4:6. He affirms the teaching of the scribes. But then he pushes their thinking. And he pushes their thinking back to himself. Right? He says, I agree, Elijah does come first to restore all things. But there's other things written in the Old Testament as well. Don't forget what's been written about the Son of Man and how he must suffer many things and be treated with contempt. So Jesus is saying, yes, Elijah has to come, but there's more. There's more in the Old Testament. Don't forget. Don't forget what's been written about the coming of the Messiah and the suffering that he must endure. Maybe he's thinking of verses like Genesis 3:15. Don't forget that verse, he's saying. Don't forget that earlier on, the earliest prophecy of a coming Messiah speaks of that Messiah being bruised in the head. Don't forget Psalm 118 that speaks of the stone that the builders, what do they do to it? They reject it. It becomes the chief cornerstone. Don't forget Isaiah 53 about the servant of the Lord, a picture of the Messiah, that he was despised and rejected by men, that he was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, a man from whom we hid our faces. So it's clear, right? Elijah must come first, but there's more written. This is not the only thing prophesied in the Old Testament. He affirms that Elijah has come, but then he starts to allude that actually the coming of Elijah was not that on the mount. It was on something that occurred earlier in the coming of John the Baptist. So Matthew's account makes clear of this story that the disciples understand this is a reference to John the Baptist, who came in the spirit of Elijah. And I think that's why he says in verse 13, but I tell you that Elijah has come, past tense, right? And they did to him whatever they pleased, as it was written of him. They treated him with contempt. They rejected him. And he's drawing their attention away from Elijah to himself and saying, so they did to the forerunner of the Messiah, they are going to do to the Messiah himself. Don't you see the parallels? Elijah, John was rejected. And the Son of Man will be rejected. And the implication here, I think, in the flow of Mark, is that any who follow John or the Son of Man will also be rejected. So this really is the same thing. As they're coming on the mountain, he's just saying the same thing that he said to them last week in chapter 8. It's very similar. Look back at verse 31 of chapter 8, maybe on the same page for you. Mark says, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed. And then look at verse 12 of our passage. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? So Jesus is just retelling them the same thing that they had a hard time swallowing last week. But now something's different. Now something's different. And what's different is that he's revealed his glory to them. So instead of Jesus vanishing when Moses and Elijah vanish, like he could have, right? No, Jesus walks back down the mountain with the three, knowing what is ahead, continuing on this path of suffering. And as they want to get caught up in a discussion about Elijah, he says, no, this whole point is that the Son of Man has to suffer. And we're going to keep going to Jerusalem on our journey and on our mission. And you disciples, you've got to keep coming with me. You've got to keep coming with me, but don't forget what you saw on the mountain. Don't forget what's coming. Be strengthened with the sight of glory. As I was thinking about it this week, it reminded me of one of my favorite parts in The Lord of the Rings. I love J.R.R. Tolkien. I love The Lord of the Rings. And in the third book, Frodo and Sam are drudging through the darkness of Mordor, barely hanging on to this epic quest that they are on to destroy the great evil ring. They have long suspected that they are not going to make it back. And now they're even wondering if they're going to make it to the end at all. And then, because they're in Mordor and there's darkness is surrounding them, right? And maybe for some of you, you can relate to that this morning. That there's just darkness all around. But then listen to what happens and what gives them the strength to move on. Tolkien writes, Sam struggled with his own weariness, and he took Frodo's hand, and there he sat, silent until deep night fell. And there, peeping among the cloud rack above, a dark tor high up above them in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. Amen. Hope is restored to Sam's heart when he sees that the shadow is not all that there is. Beyond that is light and beauty that will go on forever. And I want to contend this morning that that's what the transfiguration is meant to do in the lives of the disciples. That this little glimpse, this beauty and glory of what's coming is meant to help the disciples pick up their feet, put one in front of the other, and keep going, bearing their cross, following Jesus. For us, brothers and sisters, this means that we need to endure hardship. We need to endure hardship. We saw last week that the road to follow Jesus is hard. It includes an incredible amount of self-denial, and it's like carrying a cross. But we can endure hardship with hope. With hope, because this road that we're on, this straight and narrow path, is one day going to come to an end, and all of our suffering is going to precede glory. This is how the kingdom operates. Suffering comes first, and then comes glory. It was in Jesus' life, and it's in our life. I was really helped this week reading this Anglican minister, J.C. Ryle, who died in 1900, writing about the transfiguration. Listen to what he says. He says that this story, this event, was meant to teach the disciples that though their Lord was lowly and poor in appearance now, he would one day appear in such royal majesty as fitted the Son of God. It was meant to teach them that when their master came the second time, his saints, like Moses and Elijah, would appear with him. It was meant to remind them that though they are reviled and persecuted now, because they belong to Christ, they would one day be clothed with honor and share in their master's glory. So think back. Think back to the beginning. I listed all these trials that we're facing. Financial, health, relationships, mistreatment, disappointment, mental health. This vision of Jesus revealing his glory is meant to squelch any doubt in your heart this morning that's brought on by these difficulties. Listen to J.C. Ryle again. He's so good. He said, the vision of the holy mountain is a gracious pledge that glorious things are in store for the people of God. Glorious things are coming to you. Don't lose heart. Don't lose heart. The glory that that inner circle of those disciples got a little bit of glimpse of, you're going to get in full one day. You're going to get in full. So think on that. Think on what is to come. Look at back at how Peter responds. He's speaking out of fear, and he's a little misguided, but I think he says something good. He calls Jesus rabbi. I'm not sure how he can call him rabbi in light of what he's seen, right? This just means teacher. But the main thing he says is, it's good that we are here. It's good to be in your glory, Lord. I'll quote him again. J.C. Ryle says, what comfort and consolation the sight of glory can give the true believer. The sight of these two saints in glory with their Lord was so cheering and life-giving that Peter just wanted it to go on. He says, one day, we all, with one voice and one heart, when we see Christ return, will say, it is good for us to be here. And that's what we need to think about, beloved. That's what we got to think about. That's what we need to dwell on. And we need to pray, right? So as we wait, as we catch little glimpses of this in creation, right, that reveals His glory that I talked about earlier and that we saw Samwise Gamgee get refreshed by, the creation just gives us a little foretaste of the glory of God that's to come. So don't neglect it. Enjoy it. Let it refresh you. But pray also for a deeper heart worship treasuring of the risen Jesus. I don't think that we need, most of us, need new information about Christ. What we need is for our hearts to be set on fire at the experience of the glory of God. I want to read to you an illustration that helps by Tim Keller. Listen to this. This is helpful. He said, it's one thing to be told that someone is remarkably attractive. You believe it. But then you actually see him or her up close and you say, oh, wow. Right? What happened? Did you get new information? No, you're just experiencing what you already knew to be true. Or someone says, this restaurant is unbelievable. It's the best. You believe that when they tell you, but then you go there and eat and you're bowled over even still. Did you get new information? No, you got an experience of it, which you knew to be true. It's one thing to be told that the glorious Creator God loves you, cares for you, holds you. It's another thing to sense it, to experience it. Whatever life brings you, you will need those foretastes to nourish and strengthen you. The transfiguration is not just to be a miraculous parlor trick to convince the disciples that Jesus is truly God. It's also meant to be an experience of collective worship that they are going to need for what lies ahead. For what lies ahead. And we know in this life, hardship lies ahead for those who follow Jesus. And so we need to pray, Lord, meet us in worship. Meet us in times in your word. Meet us as we look at creation and see your glory. Meet us as we think on the light of the glory of the gospel. Because we need that to press on. So, brothers and sisters, it's a glorious thing and shows the kindness of our good shepherd, right? That at the point that the disciples, all the most tempted to lose heart, give up, stop, Jesus pulls them aside and he intentionally encourages them with a small foretaste of what's to come so that they can walk back down the mountain and follow him all the way to Jerusalem. This is what glory does to the human heart. And one day, brothers and sisters, we are going to experience such an amount of glory that every trial you're walking through now, every difficulty you're walking through now, is going to be like a distant dream to you. It's going to be like a distant dream. Let me close with the way Paul says this in 2 Corinthians 4. Listen to this. Paul says, "So we don't lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." Amen. Amen. Let's live for that day. Let me pray.